The sports rorts story has really highlighted how angry Australians get when we think our governments have betrayed our trust. Interestingly, though, our levels of trust in our politicians and some of our major institutions have been dipping sharply for some time. So why do we still care? Well, it could relate to the way we see trust in our own relationships, and it makes a difference to the quality of our public life too. What do you think would help rebuild trust in our public institutions? AJ Brown is with us today. He's a Professor of Public Policy and Law at Griffith University and a board member of Transparency International. Welcome to Life Matters, AJ.
Hello, Hilary. Good to be with you.
And Anne Tiernan too. She's Dean of Engagement at Griffith Business School and Chair of the Queensland Independent Remuneration Tribunal. Welcome to you, Anne.
G'day, Hilary.
Now, AJ, you're in Berlin at a meeting of Transparency International, and this year's Corruption Perceptions Index was launched there recently. How are we feeling about our institutions lately in Australia?
Well, it's not even a matter of how we feel about our own institutions, Hilary. This is a worldwide index that's compiled out of how a lot of people think about us and about Australia's institutions, including Australian experts and business people, etc., but also others from all around the world. And what I think is very clear now is that Australia has slumped in terms of how much people trust our government internationally compared to all other governments. We're still relatively high across the board, but since 2012, Australia's fallen about 8 points on the 100-point scale, sort of well out of the top 10 that we used to be in. And it's a clear indicator. We're now sort of stalled somewhere around 12th or 13th place. And it's a real indicator that whereas we not only used to trust our own institutions more, other countries used to trust us more in terms of our ability to run our show fairly well, and that's really hanging in the balance now as to whether that confidence is going to ever recover or stay stalled or continue to slide.
So when we look at the sports rorts issue, if we perceive that the government is probably corrupt anyway, why are we so upset about this? Isn't this just business as usual?
Well, I think, as you mentioned, the slide in the indicators of people's level of trust in government has been going on for a while, and it does go up and down over the long term, but we've really seen since over the last decade, roughly, people's trust in government to do the right thing fall to its lowest level ever. And I think that's an indicator that we risk heading towards some kind of tipping point where really our political system and our institutions and the relationships on which they rely are really starting to sort of reach a real point of jeopardy that's going to cost us in terms of governance and cost us in terms of the quality of our whole public life. And that's the real fear that's worrying people in Australia, but also in other countries as well.
But does something like the sports rorts issue have as much of an impact on us as a more interpersonal breach of trust, like theft or lying?
Well, I think the reason why this particular rort has sort of transcended simply being sort of your typical political rort into being what is in effect political corruption is that it is an abuse of trust. Where people expect politicians to lie, you know, little white lies, and a lot of politics is about gilding the lily, and people expect that. But when there's an actual direct betrayal of trust of some kind that involves lying, in this case, to hundreds and thousands of Australians, then it is like a real personal betrayal of trust.
Can you give us an example of how that might play out in our minds when we think about those day-to-day examples that make us so upset when we're betrayed?
Yeah, sure. I mean, there are examples in families, there's an example in personal life, there's betrayals of trust between partners in relationships where lies are told about extramarital affairs or any of those sorts of things. It's a bit like, I mean, if I was to lend my son the car keys and I ask him, well, what do you want them for? And he says, well, because I want to go around and visit grandma. And I say yes, and then I find out that in fact he's gone and done something completely different, and or gone out with his mates or worse, when what we were relying on was the fact that he was going to use it to go and visit grandma, then it's like a small betrayal of trust, which will have an impact on the relationship. And depending on the circumstances, it'll have a severe impact, and you won't necessarily get the car keys again. And what people, I think, do realise about the sports rorts is that hundreds and thousands of everyday Australians out there trusted the government when the government said, if you apply for this grant for your sports club, then you have, you know, an equal chance of getting some deserving resources for your little sports club. But in fact, that wasn't the case, because the criteria that were published were simply not followed, and a whole different set of politically motivated criteria actually overrode what was promised to all those hundreds and thousands of everyday Australians.
Now, you and Anne AJ both have essays in the latest edition of the Griffith Review, and there's a lot of data cited there from local and international sources saying, yep, we don't trust our governments as much now as we used to. And in fact, there was an all-time level of low trust in governments generally in Australia before the last election. Yet we did give them the car keys back. Why did we vote them back in? Is it a difference in the definition of trust in governments compared to within our relationships?
Well, I think, and this is where, I mean, I think I'm waiting for Anne's answer, but I think where we recognise is that where we're now involved in a type of politics where people don't have effectively much choice, because all political parties, especially major political parties, are forced to play the game in much the same way, then it's very hard to say that anybody was really trusting anybody with the car keys. I think a lot of Australian citizens feel that they're between a rock and a hard place, and how to break out of that style of politics into something that will rebuild genuine trust is, I think, one of our big challenges.
And Tiernan, you've written in your essay that historically, post-white settlement Australia, white Australians were quite trusting of their public institutions and governments. Why was that?
Yeah, that's right, Hilary. So I'm with a colleague at Melbourne University, Jenny Lewis, editing an Oxford Handbook of Australian Politics that will be out, you know, later this year or early next year. And, you know, it's been really interesting for me as a political scientist looking back over Australia's history. We have, for a variety of reasons, much more positive and benign views of the role of government and expectation on government that's very different to, for example, the United States, where governments are deeply distrusted. And what's really interesting to me is how much democratic innovation, how much adaptation and capacity to develop a holding centre in our politics has really held. And, you know, we have some really entrenched, enduring values, fairness, inclusion. You know, there's lots of flaws in our politics, but actually we have expectations of governments. And I think, you know, AJ's really nailed it. When he says that, you know, we're disappointed because we expect something different. And why we expect something different is because representatives, elected representatives, aren't there to represent themselves. They're not there to advance their own party political interests, actually. Our civic expectation of them is that they will steward public resources and they will make decisions for all Australians. And I think that's been, you know, laid spectacularly bare in some of the recent controversies. And it's because we expect better that we get disappointed.
And as you point out too, though, Anne, that might have played out very differently for Indigenous Australians, whose levels of trust might have been
absolutely
very differently shaped.
Absolutely. And I think it's really important that people read the essay in its entirety for that reason. But I'm really struck by, you know, the opportunity that this presents. So we talk a lot about distrust. We talk a lot about the collapse in trust really since 2007. And you can see it in the Edelman Trust Barometer and the transparency data that that AJ talks about in his Constitutional Values Survey, in the Australian Election Study. We see all that. But the people who are trusted, the people who continue to be trusted in our public life, are frontline workers, are the firefighters, are the AMBOs, are the other people. And I think that's a really interesting building foundation for trust, because it's a long way away from hyper-partisan politics, which is what so many Australians find deeply off-putting, and this political class that's just determined to campaign constantly and not to actually do the job they've been elected to do, which is to govern. Yeah. And that's a trait that has sort of been a feature of Australian politics for the last, 10 years.
And AJ, I wanted to go to you. The changes in our relationship with media in recent decades, how significant are they when it comes to looking at our relationship with our democracy?
Well, they're huge, for two reasons. One is that the way in which the media has changed has really contributed to the dynamic that Anne was just describing, particularly over the last decade. Why is it that our political leaders are developing this deserved reputation for not focusing on the outcomes and the public welfare? And it's because they're forced by the nature of the media and social media and the collapse of the traditional media, especially over the last decade. They're really forced into a game of everyday survival where the perception that of what they're doing is, as opposed to the reality, fighting that perception, creating that perception is all-consuming in and of itself. And married to that is the fact that our ability to really know what they're doing and be confident, and for us to trust that we know what they're doing, is eroded when we're dependent on this sort of hugely fragmented landscape of social media, and it's very difficult to know who's telling the truth, and opinion becomes fact. And so that we've got some really, and again, we're not the only country experiencing this, obviously, but we have this huge advantage of being a country in which there is compulsory voting, and in which there is a long-term commitment for people to take an interest. We believe in our system in that long-term sense, and we maintain our compulsory voting. And so people really, they get out there and they think, yeah, well, we're supposed to give a damn, we're supposed to vote, we're supposed to know something, we're supposed to make a judgment. And when they try to, it's much, much harder now because of the degree of manipulation and the degree of fragmentation. So it's a really, when we're ever going to come out of this particular spiral is a really good question, but it really has a huge impact on our ability to trust when we're so uncertain about the information we're being given.
And Tiernan, what implications does this have for us day to day? If we don't trust our governments and institutions, does that have an impact on our ability to trust on a local level?
I think AJ's hit on something very interesting there, and he has a much more benign view of the role of politicians in this media kind of landscape. My research is on executive advice and the extraordinary growth of ministerial staffing arrangements. And I think that, yes, the media landscape is profoundly disrupted. Yes, social media is a really important thing, but actually in lots of ways, politicians, and they describe it themselves as being in this kind of Stockholm syndrome, but you start to proliferate people whose only focus is issues management and spin, and it creates its own dynamic. And I actually think that's the vortex that the federal government particularly is in. And it's compounded by the lack of integrity and accountability frameworks and scrutiny frameworks. It's much harder to do this kind of stuff at the state levels in Australia where corruption bodies exist, because governments have to be more transparent. It doesn't mean there aren't problems, of course, but it actually means that information for engaged citizens and journalists is, even with the constraints on journalists' time, is easier to get. What it means on a local level is that all of this breeds cynicism. And I argue in my essay that cynicism is exactly what people who are not interested in integrity, accountability, governing properly want us to be doing. And they're cultivating cynicism in a way so that we will disengage. And I think we really have to challenge that. I think AJ's point about compulsory voting is extraordinarily well made. Actually, trust requires frequent interactions with people. And, a much underexplored dimension of the loss of trust is the extent to which our society is so atomized, the kinds of traditional institutions and structures that might once have brought people into contact with each other have really diminished. And, you know, they've brought a lot of disgrace and reasons to distrust them on themselves if we think about churches and, you know, other kinds of institutions that have had such difficulties. But I really think it's, and we can see it, right, in, you know, Fran's been down on the south coast, people getting together, forming alliances, doing things together, that builds trust. And those are the things that are the core of social cohesion. So my argument is, don't leave it. That's not somebody else's responsibility to do that. It's actually our civic responsibilities to know, to get involved, to demand accountability and to participate, frankly. And there's actually a lot we can do.
And we've got a few callers wanting to join in this discussion too with Anne Tiernan and AJ Brown. Dr. Sarah Russell is in Mount Martha in Victoria. And Sarah, you've got thoughts on those institutional abuses that we've seen uncovered recently. Tell us what you would like to say.
Well, I'm actually interested in what Anne's been saying in relation to aged care. Exactly what she's been saying has played out in the Royal Commission into aged care. We've seen the lack of transparency leads to lack of trust, leads to anger, leads to everything escalating. And it's become this hotbed of distrust between families and aged care homes and aged care providers. And it's all because of the lack of transparency, in my opinion.
So you'd like to see that change, obviously. Do you think we're moving forward with that?
Well, I'm actually very keen now to circulate Anne's essay, because I think if the providers could read her essay and if families could read her essay, we could see that we're only going to improve things if we engage in a transparent way. I'm a researcher into aged care and I can't get data because the providers keep it all secret. And my last comment really is in relation to the fact that the aged care minister is also the sports minister. And when the warts were exposed, his only response was to go after the whistleblower. So I just find it really curious, because when anyone makes a complaint about aged care to the minister, he goes into this spin. And it's just losing trust. And it just needs to improve.
Sarah, thanks so much for joining in the discussion today. And there is a lot of hope and inspiration in both AJ's and Anne's essays that appear in the latest edition of the Griffith Review. And Caroline's in the Blue Mountains with a really interesting community engagement example. Caroline, welcome to you.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What have you been involved in?
Well, I've had to do research for a local community talk about citizens' assemblies, and I really knew nothing about what that was before. And it's fascinating. I'd love to hear more about it from shows like yours. If you think of it being like a jury service, but ramped up to 100 people, one's being set up in the UK on climate justice by the UK government, about to meet soon. It's been used in Ireland for the abortion debate. Maruya Council are using them. So the 100 people are randomly selected, so they're representative of the community. So they get the trust of the community because people feel represented. They get a facilitated process to look at the issue with stakeholders and public submissions, and they come up with recommendations that are well thought through. And they can also look at a long-term perspective instead of being trapped into these short election cycles. And I just think it's the way forward. It actually comes from ancient Greece originally. It's bringing democracy back to the people. You don't need gender quotas. You'd have 50% at least female representation. So how good is that?
Democracy in action, in practice. Yeah. Caroline, thank you.
And the New Democracy Foundation in Australia is the body that tries to further this cause. There's lots of examples out there. Please check it out.
There you go. You can chase it up yourself. We're chatting with Professor Anne Tiernan, Dean of Engagement at Griffith Business School, and Professor AJ Brown, Professor of Public Policy and Law at Griffith University. And just to finish up with, what kinds of organisations might be models for building trusting relationships within the community? CWA, Movember, sporting clubs, what would stand out for you?
All of those. And, you know, I think this always happens in Australia. And this is, you know, what the really interesting thing about this holding centre, this sense of shared values about what needs to happen when people are vulnerable. And you know, you can read a bit more about it, and historians have documented this very well. The CWA is a rapidly growing organisation. Many young people are joining it. But have a look at the disaster response. Have a look at the people who are self-organising. That capacity exists. You know, the people from different cultural communities who turned out to serve meals and so on. There is something something unique and distinctive about that in the Australian culture. And I think that's an immense strength. And so while it is tempting to, you know, throw up your hands and be cynical, you know, my view is that's exactly what people who don't want to be transparent and who want to hold power to themselves and use incumbency for just relentless partisan advantage want you to do. So confound it, challenge it, disrupt it by being engaged and understanding this democratic inheritance that many, many people have fought over. And, Australia was not slipping down the list in the early part of this century, but in fact regarded as an international leader. And I think we can recapture that again. But it will require what I call unconventional alliances of people who are not part of that hyper-partisan tribalism, people who just want to live ordinary lives and deliver their children and families and communities a better outcome.
And AJ, finally to you, you intriguingly wrote about the drive to corruption in your essay, but also perhaps a drive to fairness that we might have that might help us out.
I think that's exactly right. And I think Anne is right that is one of the great parts of the Australian makeup. And I've got to say, having gone full circle from Fran being at Batemans Bay, having been at Batemans Bay on New Year's Eve myself, I can think of quite a few people who have really shown in the wake of that exactly the type of spirit that Anne is talking about. I can think of some firefighters at Nelligan, for example, who really showed that there is a different reality out there to the hyper-partisan sort of self-marketing politics that we've seen. So I think we have to hold out some hope, and we need to hold out some hope. And I think if anybody can buck these sorts of trends and turn them around, then I'd like to join Anne in thinking that it is the Australian sort of political psyche that should be able to do it once again.
Confound, challenge and disrupt. There's some powerful words to leave us with. Professor Anne Tiernan and Professor AJ Brown, thanks so much for joining us on Life Matters.
A real pleasure, Hilary.
Anne Tiernan, Dean of Engagement at Griffith Business School, and Professor AJ Brown, Professor of Public Policy and Law at Griffith University. Professor Anne Tiernan, I should say. And you're listening to Life Matters.